You're listening to The Taylor Marshall Show, episode 58, and I'm very excited because many of you, listeners and readers, have sent in questions about some of the secret meanings and, yes, even secret hidden theology in my new novel, Sword and Serpent. Although it is a novel, there is a lot of theology between the lines. So even if you haven't read the book, I probably won't do any spoilers here, so don't worry. But if you haven't read the book, I'm going to talk about some of those secret meanings, and we're going to get into some deep theology that relates to the historical saints depicted in the book. So stay tuned. Howdy, and thank you for tuning into The Taylor Marshall Show. This is the podcast for everyone who wants to create daily habits and learn enough theology to take their faith to the next level. And my goal this week is to answer your questions, theological questions, about my new book, Sword and Serpent. So let's get started. Well, hey, welcome back to The Taylor Marshall Show. And before we get started, I want to send a shout out to a Catholic priest who has been a huge encouragement to me, and his name is Father Jeffrey Wharton. Father, I know you're listening, and I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. For the listeners, Father Jeff Wharton is a former Episcopalian priest like I am, but he went on to become an ordained, full-out Catholic priest. He's married, he has children, and he's also a chaplain for our military here in the United States. He's deployed. He works hard defending our nation and also bringing the sacraments and hope and faith and grace to our men and women who are serving in the armed forces. So, Father Wharton, thank you. The reason I want to send out a shout out to Father Jeffrey Wharton today is every week, Father Wharton says a mass with the intention for this podcast. He listens to this podcast and he feels that it's important. And so he says a mass in preparation for this podcast. And what I love about it is I know when I'm recording this podcast, either that day or the day before, the day after, Father has said a mass for this show. So if there's anything good in this show, it's probably because it's coming through the sacramental graces obtained by Father Jeffrey Wharton. So Father, thank you so much. And all of you listening, please pray for Father Jeffrey and for his family. Okay, so this show, we're going to be talking about something a little bit different. It's a novel. I've written a novel a while back. I talked about this in the episode about being more creative, and this is my go at it. This is my first big public creative work, and I was afraid about it. I still am nervous, you can ask my wife, but I'm really excited. Today was the day we announced it. It debuted at number one on Amazon for young adult historical religious fiction, and also number one young adult historical action fiction, which is just simply amazing. And I need to thank, especially at this moment, the St. George launch team. All of you that signed up over a month ago to read an advanced copy and to help promote it and rate it, thank you so much. I know many of you are listeners of this podcast, and I wanted to thank you here on the show, because without you, this book would not have been as successful as it is so quickly on the opening day. So thank you so much. There's already well over 200 positive 4-star, 5-star reviews, and that's really thanks to y'all who have just pushed and supported and promoted this book. So thank you so very much. Now, my goal this week is to answer some questions. Many of you have already read Sword and Serpent. Even if you haven't, don't worry. You can still listen to this podcast, and I'm not going to give away any spoilers because there are a lot of twists and turns in the plot. But many have written asking about certain themes, certain saints. There are a lot of historical saints. As a way of background, this novel begins historically in the year AD 299. Historically, the Emperor Diocletian was trying to get to discern the future, the omens, through the heruspects, or in, if it's plural, heruspices, which is an interesting Latin word. These are men who tell omens, who can foretell outcomes in the empire with regard to economics, war, battle. the pagan emperors relied on these men. And in the year 299, historically, this really did happen, it's not just part of a fiction book, they stopped working. In other words, they could no longer read the vital organs and the oracles, not the oracles, but the vital organs of the sacrificial animals. And so Diocletian and the priests blamed the Christians. It was the Christians' fault why this was happening, this very important religious, significant pagan office was failing in the empire in 299. And so Diocletian launched the most violent and bloody persecution against Christians in the history of the Roman Empire. It was absolutely horrible, and many of the great saints that you know come from this period because they were martyred under the bloody reign of Diocletian. So that's the backdrop for this story. And woven into the narrative, of course, is this tale, the legend of Saint George and the dragon. Also living at this time are men like St. Christopher, who identifies St. Menas, and St. Nicholas, and St. Blaise, and Constantine. All of these people are in the book. It's all woven together into an exciting adventure with a lot of plot twists. Most people are saying this is a really fast read, a page-turner. They've enjoyed it. Many of them read it in just one sitting, even though it's about 400 pages or two sittings, because they couldn't put it down. There's so much action in this book. And there's a lot of questions about the theology, and I wanted to make this book not preachy. I didn't want people to think that this was just an apologetics book wrapped up as fiction, or that it was somehow tricked you. You just read a Christian book, and now there's three or four pages explaining the gospel and why you should accept Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior. I want it to be much more subtle. So someone who's an atheist or someone who's Jewish or Muslim or whoever could read this book and find value in it without there being a lot of gushy Christian rhetoric in the book. So because of that, and because some of the theology is couched in a literary way, people have caught on to it, they're excited about it, and they have a lot of questions about it. So I'm going to try to answer some of that without giving away hopefully no spoilers, but too many spoilers. And if you haven't read the book, and if you end up do reading the book, you'll have kind of a better appreciation. If you have read the book, maybe this will give you the key to unlock some of the mysteries written in Sword and Serpent. Okay, so before we do that, I'm going to start off with the proverb of the week. And the proverb of the week is Proverb 25, verse 25. It goes like this: like cold water to a thirsty soul, so is good news from a far country, end quote. I like this proverb because it reminds me of the Lord of the Rings, Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, which is a big inspiration for me as I was writing Sword and Serpent. You know, think back in the Lord of the Rings, there's all these battles, there's all these things that are happening, good and bad, and every once in a while, there'll be glad tidings from a faraway land that another army's coming, or that Gandalf is coming, or something has happened, something has changed in a faraway place that affects the characters here and now. What I like about this is it's a very Catholic proverb. It teaches us that no man is an island. We are not alone. We all need good news from far away. And that's really the genius of being part of a universal church. We are not the Church of England or the church of your local neighborhood. We are the church of this world, the body of Christ. And therefore, the world's news, good and bad, is our news. So that's the proverb of the week, Proverbs 25:25, like cold water to a thirsty soul, so is good news from a faraway country. Okay, let's jump back into the featured segment, some Q&A, some listener questions about Sword and Serpent. Many people have asked, where did this idea come from? And it started way back in 2006 when I became a Catholic. And I've talked about this before. It was a very difficult, discouraging, and even depressing year. It was a time in which I went from being an Episcopalian clergyman to being a Catholic layman in a big, gigantic church that I did not fully understand. I knew I wanted to be Catholic. I knew I wanted the Eucharist. I agreed with all the teachings of the church and had researched them thoroughly. But still, the culture of being Catholic and everything that was new for our family was difficult, and I sort of doubted, not my decision, but doubted who I was. You know, I was confused about what my place was and what I was going to end up doing in the future. I'd always seen myself as a minister or as a pastor, and now that had all changed. So a lot of that angst, a lot of that discouragement and even despair, I wrote into this story about St. George. It's about a young man who needs to find his place in this world. He is a nominal Christian. His parents were Christian. But even in 299, he doesn't really understand what this religion is all about. And so it's a journey in which he understands the meaning of self-sacrifice and the joy of serving a bigger cause and serving something other than himself. So that's kind of the background of the story. And I started telling it as bedtime stories to my oldest son, Gabriel. He was very much into knights. I think we had been to medieval times when he was 3 years old or 4 years old, and he was really into long swords and shields and armor and helmet at this time. And at Christmas that year, he got all this knight stuff. And at night, he wanted to hear stories about chivalry and knights and horses. So I would tell them. And since we were new converts to the Catholic Church, I began to work in saints. And of course, the favorite saint of these stories was St. George, because he was kind of like a knight. He was a soldier, and he slayed the horrible dragon. So as these stories were told, and eventually we introduced figures like St. Nicholas and St. Christopher, all who lived the same time as St. George, they began to mature and get more complex. And a priest friend of mine who I worked for at that time, Monsignor Bill Stetson of Opus Dei, he encouraged me to start writing them down, which I did, and eventually they became a novel. They became a full-out book. I remember drinking Grand Marnier almost every evening and typing out this story. And the taste and smell of Grand Marnier still reminds me of those early days writing this novel. And eventually I made it a more mature book, and it became the novel it is today, which is really for adults and young adults. It may be, it's completely clean, but it may have some themes and some violence in it that would upset children under the age of 12. But I want to thank especially my friends, Shannon Valenzuela and Jennifer Braylick, who helped me recreate this novel. They're both authors, and wonderfully, they're both women. And so they were able to help me recreate the person and the character of Sabra, who is just so key to this novel. And I was worried that as a man, I would not be able to voice a strong, powerful, feminine character. I also didn't want female readers reading the novel and them to think that, well, the Sabra is just a token female character. I really wanted her to be as good, equal with the character of George, who's also a very strong, powerful character in the book. So that's the background to the story. I think the novel is wonderful. Even when I went back to reread it, I laughed, I cried. It really does move me. And I think there is something very supernatural about this book. And of course, I've prayed to St. George a lot in writing and preparing it. So let's get down to some of your questions. It's been really fun to see the emails come in and hear your excitement in the emails, and also to see your questions. Okay, so one of the questions that comes in is about the struggle that Sabra has as a priestess in preparing these children to be killed. If you're familiar with the ancient legend of St. George, there is a city, Cyrene, which I've taken to be Cyrene, which has a great parallel of St. Simon of Cyrene, which is in the book. And Sabra, who is the daughter of the king in the legend, in this story, is not just the daughter or the princess, she's also the priestess of the ancient Phoenician cult. And therefore, it's her task to prepare these young children to be sacrificed. Because in the legend of St. George, as you may know, this is the legend, this is not necessarily this book, but this is the background legend. There was a giant dragon or demon outside the city, and he would eat the people unless they fed him their children. So they would prepare every month a lottery, and if the lot fell to your family, you had to provide a child to be sacrificed to this horrible beast. That's the background. That's the legend of St. George. And so I took that legend and elaborated on it and made it so that the daughter of the king would have to prepare, the daughter of the governor would have to prepare these children for sacrifice. So a question that comes in is Sabra, who is a pagan, she's not a Christian, she's not baptized, is she doing what she believes is the right thing for the city? This taps into a question that St. John Paul II talked about in Veritatis Splendor, and that is, can an evil act be made good or righteous by a good or righteous intention? Many moral theologians, ethicists, would say that, yeah, you know, as long as you're trying to do the right thing, it's okay. Now, what do we believe about that as Christians? Well, if something is intrinsically evil and you have a good intention in doing it, it does not change it from being intrinsically evil. We're going to look at two examples here. The first one is a case that's not intrinsically evil. A man gets another man to lie down, and then he chops off his arm. Is that an evil act? Well, it depends on the circumstance and the intention. If someone says, here, lie down on the ground real quick and close your eyes, I want to give you a present or something like that, and then pulls out a machete and chops off his right arm, that is a gravely evil act. But if the man who says lie down is a doctor, and he lies down on a hospital bed, and then he amputates his arm because of some sort of cancer or gangrene on that arm, it's actually a good and righteous and noble act. Because the doctor is intending to save the man's life, not do him long-lasting harm. You see that right there? So again, in moral theology, there are certain acts that are not intrinsically evil, and if there's the proper intent and circumstance, it can be a righteous act. John Paul II says, you know, but a lot of people have taken that kind of example and they've stretched it way too far. So St. John Paul II says, people have taken that and applied it to, say, abortion, and therefore tried to make abortion sometimes good or okay. For example, a girl wants to go to college, become educated, earn a great income, be married, and have a nuclear family. All of those are good intentions. We all applaud that. Yes, that's wonderful. Therefore, if the girl at age 16 finds herself pregnant and she intends to go to college, become educated, get a great job, marry a great man, and have a nuclear family, if that's her intention, therefore, it's okay for her to have an abortion because her intent is something really, really good, something that we all acknowledge as being good. John Paul II says, no, that doesn't work. There are intrinsically evil acts. In an intrinsically evil act, it doesn't matter what the circumstance or what the intention is, it is always evil. And abortion is one of those examples. So when we come back into this story, people love Sabra. When they read this novel, they love Sabra. Even some people even say she, you know, they love her more than George or Jurian in the book. And so as they see her developing psychologically and her struggling with this vocation she has as a priestess to sacrifice kids to this horrible presence in the hills, they ask the question, is she virtuous? Is she a good person? And what about her intention? Her intention is to save the city and to save all of her people from being destroyed by this horrible demonic beast that threatens the lives of everyone in the city. Well, I think if we brought St. John Paul II to this situation, we would see that this act is intrinsically evil. And in fact, I want to be careful in saying this in case the book gets more and more popular, but I wrote this novel as an implicit criticism of the culture of death, because the ancient story of St. George, in which we have child sacrifice to a demonic figure, is a parallel in our own time of keeping the social status quo by allowing and legalizing abortion. Yeah, I think you can see the one-to-one right there. So this book is a criticism on the culture of death. But we can see here that even though Sabra has a right intention and the circumstances are very extreme, it still is morally evil. It's not morally permissible. And I think this really makes the story even more intense as we find her journeying to Rome, eventually meeting up with Jury, and that is George, and the rest of the gang. And I don't want to give away anything more there because it'll spoil the story for anyone listening who hasn't read the book. So that answers that question about Sabra and her pagan, non-Christian intentions. Another one has to do with Minas. In the book, very early on, George and his sister, and I keep saying George, but in the book, his name is Jurian, which is a Germanic form of George, and there's some significance there with relation to a prophecy and the Pope, and I can't explain that here because it's, again, another spoiler, but as I'm talking, I'll be saying Jurian or George, it's the same person. In the book, Jurian, that is George, meets a character named Minas, who's a large man with six toes. This harkens back to the Philistines and the person of St. Christopher, or St. Minas, who was allegedly a Philistine. And in the Old Testament, we read of some Philistines with six digits. And so I gave him that attribute to make him memorable, but also to make him remind us of the ancient, gigantic, mutant Philistines who fought against the Israelites. So this character, Minas, he's named Minas because there is a historical saint named St. Minas who has almost the exact same biography as St. Christopher in the West. So St. Christopher, his name Christophoros in Greek means the bearer of Christ, the carrier of Christ. And according to that tradition, there was a really horrible man named Reprobos, and he served the devil and he lived a life of mortal sin. And one day, a small child asked him to carry him across a river. The child was too small, he couldn't get across, so this horrible man lifted up the child and carried him across the river. But as he carried him across the river, the child became more and more heavy, and he almost drowned. His face began to go under the water. And when they got to the other side, he said, "How could you be so heavy? You're just a little kid, just a little boy." And the boy revealed himself as the Lord Jesus Christ and suddenly turned into a full-grown man and said, "The weight that you felt was the weight of the sins of the world. I allowed you to bear for a moment a part of the sins of the world." And in that moment, this man, Reprobos, converted, became a Christian, and was baptized by Christ there in the water, and Christ changed his name to Christopher or Christophoros. That is the background legend of Saint Christopher. Now, there's another saint from Egypt who has almost the same story. He's also the patron of travelers, and his name is Menas, M-E-N-A-S. So I felt that it was appropriate to bring these two saints together. And so that's why in the book, although Menas is sometimes called the Christ bearer or the Christopher, and as you read the book, it's kind of a wink-wink. You'll get it as you read it. But I wanted to associate him with Menas, because Menas, the historical Menas, has ties to the Roman military. And as you get to the last pages of Sword and Serpent, you'll see why this is so important for Menas or Christopher's identity. So yes, when you see the name Menas, I'm tying together these two legends. If you go to Wikipedia and look up St. Menas or St. Christopher, you'll find some things written there about how these legends are related, and that was written in part by myself as I did research for this. So if you read the Wikipedia article, my hand is in there with the research, making things clear, because I've done a lot of research on this topic. Okay, another question that comes in is the role of good old Saint Nicholas. Nicholas in this book is a mystical figure. He is kind of like, he's not really a Gandalf because he's not a wizard, but he does have supernatural knowledge and supernatural power. He can bilocate. And he has very interesting appearances throughout the book, even all the way to the end. There is a really important scene at the end of the book. I have to be careful how I mention this, with Nicholas, and it's the Let It Go scene, for those of you that have read it. And by Let It Go, I don't mean, sorry, that sounds so horrible and cliche because it sounds like the movie Frozen, like, let it go, let it go. No, Nicholas says, let go to Sabra. And that scene is intended to be an exorcism. And if you're Catholic and you read that scene, you'll get it. Maybe some readers didn't get it, but I think when you read that, you'll realize that there's a great deliverance happening there in that scene. And Nicholas, of course, by his supernatural powers, is able to do some things there that most human beings would not be able to do by virtue of him being holy and in virtue of him being a priest. Also, for those of you that bought the initial run of Sword and Serpent, and there are still copies available, the first 3,000 printed copies have an extra bonus chapter in there in which Mari appears to Nicholas in a dream. It's very mystical. It's very theological. I don't want to talk about it here because it will give things away. But if you have one of those first 3,000 first editions of the book Sword and Serpent, you'll find that extra chapter in the back. And if you have it, your cover will say bonus content inside. Again, you can get that at Amazon.com. And that first edition is not yet sold out. So if you're interested in this book and you want to get the limited edition one with the bonus chapter, get it now at Amazon. Okay, another question. Hanno is a eunuch. What is a eunuch? A eunuch is a castrated man. In antiquity, in courts, in royal courts, the men who associated with and served the women were castrated. This was because the nobility and the royals did not want their women to be assaulted or impregnated by servants. And so all the servants who came in contact with women in court were castrated. This was especially the case in North Africa and Egypt, where our story takes place. And so Hanno, who is the very close friend of Sabra, who's a princess figure, is in fact a eunuch. He's castrated. And I think that's one of the reasons why he is just so lovable. Okay, moving on to the next question. What about the historicity of the book? You'll notice as you're reading it, or if you read it, everything is very detailed, and there's a lot of research put into it. So, and also you'll find that there's Latin words throughout the book, and there's also a Latin dictionary at the end. I wanted this book to be completely historically accurate. When they get to Rome, even the geography, the way the Tiber is described, the landscape, how they get to, for example, St. Peter's tomb, going to the catacombs, all of that is intended to be historically accurate so that you could actually go to Rome and go to the places where they were standing and where they were talking. Unfortunately, the city of Cyrene, which is another important place in the book, there's not much left of that, just unlike Rome. So a lot of that had to be imagined out of nowhere. But we wanted to keep the customs, the foods, the spices, the clothing, the costumes, all of that is intended to be historically correct. So what's great about this book, especially if you gave it to like a teenager or a young person, is they would learn a lot about not only Latin words, but they would learn about Roman customs, geography. I mean, this book is all over the Mediterranean Sea, and historical facts about emperors, their rule, who was where, who was doing what. So it's almost as if we took this historical period, we injected this legend of St. Christopher and embellished it, but we kept the framing, the historical frame, completely accurate. That's what Sword and Serpent is intended to be. Now, that leads us to another question, and that is about Constantine. Constantine appears in this story. You'll know Constantine was the first Christian emperor, and he appears in this book with Diocletian, and he will have more and more of a role in future books in this series. This series, by the way, I should have said this at the beginning, Sword and Serpent is a epic saga describing how the Roman Empire started off thoroughly pagan and given over to demons and eventually becomes thoroughly Christian and becomes the bedrock for Christian Europe and the West, really for civilization. And the pivotal character on which the whole thing rotates is this young man, George, as he comes in contact with Constantine. George, historically, dies in 303 as a martyr. In 313, thereabouts, Constantine begins to make Christianity legal and then privileges it as the religion of the Roman Empire. So we're going to see in this series the effect of George on a young Constantine before he has any influence yet. He's just a young man, the son of a Caesar in Diocletian's court. And George is going to have an impact upon him and his mother, Helena, who becomes Saint Helen. So yes, Constantine's in here. There's a great scene when Jurian, that is George, gets to Rome and he has an encounter there with the emperor, and Constantine is right there in the scene. If you missed it, go back and read it, because there's a lot embedded in there and it's intended to be explained and embellished in future books in this series. Well, we're getting a little long here, so we'll just do two more questions. There's a lot of them here about the idea of the dragon, and I just can't answer those questions because it'll just spoil it for people who haven't read it. But I do want to just touch briefly on the literary triangle of George, Sabra, and the dragon. Yes, some people have seen this already. That is intended to parallel the theological triangle of Adam, Eve, and serpent. And there are a lot of little clues and kind of wink-winks and things in there for the reader to begin to see this triangle forming as you get into the last pages of the book without giving anything away. Last question. Is Jurian like Saint Simon of Cyrene? Yes. If you picked that up, you definitely got the clue. In Matthew chapter 27, we read of a man named Simon. He is from the city of Cyrene, which is the city where the legendary dragon was from. And Simon is asked to carry the cross with Jesus Christ. He doesn't want to. He's reluctant. As he carries the cross shoulder to shoulder with Jesus Christ, he converts. He becomes reborn. His sins are forgiven. He becomes a Christian. And he goes with Christ, carrying the cross all the way to Calvary with Jesus. And so, yes, there is an intentional parallel there as well, a theological parallel with Simon of Cyrene and then George as he's journeying to Cyrene, even somewhat reluctantly. Okay, well, there's some questions. There's a lot more. Oh, one more. I'll do one more. What will happen next? Well, that's the next book. I'm writing it. It's exciting. I think it's even better than the first book. It's again, I can't tell you what it's totally about because that would give away the ending. But it's going to be really exciting. It's going to be even more political. And like I said, Constantine and George's relationship will be strengthened, and there'll be some turns and some prizes along the way, definitely in book two. So stay tuned for that. Okay, well, we'll close up there. We'll also get to our tip of the week and our Latin word of the week. But before we do, I just have two announcements. The first one is, hey, 33 Mary, our Advent devotion is going awesome. Thousands and thousands of you have signed up, and you're doing the 33Mary.com consecration. It is the 33-day consecration, total consecration to Mary, to Jesus through Mary. It's not too late to sign up. You can still go to 33Mary.com. You will have missed the first several days. You can catch up. We have a PDF file there for you, so you can catch up if you still want to do it. But go check it out, 33Mary.com. And then, of course, the main announcement is Sword and Serpent. Go out there and get a copy. It's fun. It's awesome. You won't be able to put it down. It has a lot of exciting things and a lot of theology to discover hidden there in the book. So check it out, Sword and Serpent. Just go to Amazon.com and in the search bar, type in Sword and Serpent. You'll find it there. I look forward to, if you want, leave a review. I've been reading all the reviews. Or send me an email if you have questions, and I'd love to be in touch with you. Okay, the tip of the week. The tip of the week this week is called storyboarding. Storyboarding. This is whenever you write a story or develop a story, you need to plan it out. It's called storyboarding. Now, you may think, well, I'm not going to write a novel. Why do I need to know this? Listen, this applies to resumes, pitching a business deal, or just telling a goodnight story to your family. You need to know how to craft a story. So every story at the very beginning has to have a great hook. So you could be giving a presentation for your company. You could be in an interview with a future employer. You need to tell a story. Stories are what makes the world go round. People are compelled, not necessarily even by facts, but facts as arranged in a story. You must understand this. So you must storyboard any presentation you're going to be giving, and you must think. So you need a great hook. You need a surprise. Even if it's a business pitch, you need to have a surprise. And you want everyone to think, here's the key, to think that they know where the story is going and to almost be so positive that they're bored. And as soon as they get to that point, you have to change it. You have to grab them, and you have to show them that what they thought was not the case. There's a whole nother level, a whole nother dimension. Whoever can do that successfully will become a great storyteller. They will get the promotion. They will give the great speeches because they will captivate the human mind. So you must learn this gift. That's not a gift. It's not something anyone can learn to do this. You must acquire this skill. That's a much better word, skill, so that you can tell a story. And one more thing, every story should leave your audience a little bit unsatisfied. That's right. There should always be a cliffhanger at the end of every chapter, at the end of every story, at the end of every pitch, at the end of every sale. There should be something that's a little bit unsatisfying. Why? Because the whole point of telling one story is so that you can tell more stories. You want to be invited back. So if you're writing on a blog, you want people to come back to the blog and read again. If you're speaking in front of an audience, whether it's a conference or a convention, you want them to come back and hear some more. If you're writing a novel, you want them to come back and read the novel some more or read the next novel. If you're writing a book, the same way. Even if it's nonfiction, it's a book about theology or the Civil War, you want them to not be fully satisfied, but to whet their appetite for something even more. So my goal when I tell a story, let's say I'm telling a story to my children at night, I want to have the most gut-wrenching, impossible cliffhanger at the end. And then I say, okay, let's say our prayers and go to sleep. And the kids go, no, no, tell us what happened, no. And it drives them crazy. That's the point. So you want to storyboard every message you have into a narrative. So there's a hook in the beginning, twists along the way, and then whet their appetite for something even more in the future. If you use that when you're interviewed for a job or when you're asking for a promotion, it's guaranteed to work because it captures the human curiosity for learning more about something that is excellent. That's the tip of the week, storyboarding. Before we get to the Latin word of the week, just want to say there's a gift for you. Go to taylormarshall.com, free book, Thomas Aquinas in 50 pages. Yes, Augustine in 50 pages is ready. It's edited, it's perfect, it's ready to go, but we've just been so busy on this book launch for Sword and Serpent and other things going on, we haven't been able to put it up, so I think we're just going to make that available for free, as we promised, after the Christmas holidays are over. So check back at taylormarshall.com in maybe January, early January, for Augustine in 50 pages. Right now you can get Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas in 50 pages free. Just go to taylormarshall.com. Also, we'll be opening up, I forgot to mention this in the announcement, we'll be opening up the new St. Thomas Institute for the spring enrollment coming up December 15th, I believe it is. We'll announce it on December 10th on the site, but I'm telling you here first on the podcast, I think it's December 15th will be the opening day so that you can sign up. We'll allow new members, new enrollments to study theology online with me, New St. Thomas Institute. Look for that. Okay, Latin word of the week is fabulator. Fabulator. A fabulator is a storyteller. Every community had fabulatores, right? Storytellers. And they told fabula, where we get the English word fable. A fable is just a story. It doesn't necessarily need to be a myth or what we think of as a fable. It's just a story. All of us who are involved in the new evangelization, all of us who are apologists, all of us who want to share the good news of Jesus Christ and to help people get to heaven and to get ourselves to heaven through grace, need to become fabulatores, storytellers. The Gospels of Jesus Christ, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are not dogmatic theological treatises. They are stories about the Savior. We must tell those stories. We must tell those stories in a way that is compelling, in a way that resonates with our culture. So pray that you might become a fabulator, a storyteller. Well, hey, if you like this podcast, please subscribe to it. It comes out usually every Wednesday. I haven't been as faithful the last couple weeks because I was sick, and then we started doing this launch for Sword and Serpent. And while you're over there at iTunes subscribing, just go to iTunes and type in Taylor Marshall Show. While you're over there subscribing, please leave a rating if you haven't already. It allows other people to find this show more easily. You can give it a 1-star all the way up to a 5-star and then say something you like about the show. It would mean the world to me. I would really appreciate it. Thank you so much to everyone who has left a rating on the Taylor Marshall Show over at iTunes. And we'll close up with our salty closing. Remember, our Lord Jesus Christ said that you are the light of the world and the salt of the earth. So go out there and be salty. Here's a little secret message at the end of the podcast. I'm giving away an iPad and several $100 Amazon gift certificates as a promotion for Sword and Serpent by doing epic, silly, and fun things like creating the official Sword and Serpent cocktail beverage or taking an epic selfie with the book or leaving a review or a bunch of other stuff. You can win an iPad or $100 Amazon gift card. So head over to taylormarshall.com/contests, and you can see the different contests and enter to win. Hey, thanks so much. God bless. Be salty.